Tonight on Arena, Sex and the City, a reboot is on the way. And where do I begin with the music of Elmer Bernstein? #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Well, between 1999 and 2004, that was music that had many people rushing to their sofas to sit in front of the television and watch what was happening to Sarah Jessica Parker, Cynthia Nixon, Kristen Davis and Kim Cattrall, or in fact, should I say, the four characters played by them, Carrie, Charlotte, Miranda and Samantha. That is the theme music, of course, for Sex and the City, which is getting the revival treatment. The new chapter is called And Just Like That. It will star Sarah Jessica Parker, Cynthia Nixon and Kristen Davis. No Kim Cattrall. No Samantha Jones, who was in the... Kim Cattrall playing that character in the original series is not returning. Now, since the announcement of the reboot, there has been much discussion on whether the show's problematic past, especially its lack of diversity, will make it irrelevant in 2021. Jen Gannon is joining me now. Jen, even as I played that music, it kind of brought me back. It's difficult to underestimate just how innovative Sex and the City was when it first aired in 1991. It was really groundbreaking in terms of how it treated the lives of four single women in New York.
Yeah, I think people seem to have forgotten just how exciting and original the show was when it first aired in the UK and Ireland on Channel 4 in 1999. It was this really fresh, funny and totally frank look at modern life. It lifted the lid on what, you know, some women got up to in their personal lives and tried to push, you know, sexual boundaries on TV. And it put women in the driving seat for once, showing their side of the sexual escapades from their point of view. And that view wasn't always a pleasant one, that's for sure. And not only that, but it was impossibly glamorous. I don't think there has been a show so completely escapist and so beautifully luxurious, I think, since Dynasty. I mean, I hate that it's viewed as this something to be ashamed of, to admire the clothes and the lifestyle of Sex and the City, whereas something with a 60s aesthetic like Mad Men is, you know, not seen as vapid or shallow. And if Don Draper can have his Canadian Club bourbon, why can't Carrie Bradshaw have her Cosmopolitan?
But is part of the problem and part of the problems that people have perhaps with the series linked in with this idea, you said it there, it treated the lives, the sex lives, or give us an example of the sex lives of some women. It had this escapist line to it as well. Was there enough reality in there to make it a classic that lasted for longer than its first set of seasons?
I mean, I think so. I think these women, they're intensely problematic. And a lot of the time, you know, you were seeing them as not, you know, likeable. They're far removed from that plucky, can-do single gal we were used to seeing on TV at the time. They were aggressive, anxiety-ridden, obsessive, selfish, needy, obnoxious. They were just as complicated as their male anti-hero counterparts. And, you know, Carrie Bradshaw is not a good person in the same way that, as I said, Don Draper is not a good person, and we shouldn't aspire to be them at all. But I think, yeah, it's a very narrow point of view of these very wealthy women that they were showing. But at the same time, the show was truly great when it spoke to its female audience, whether that was at the facetious end of things where you're talking about them discussing vibrators or the female body or men with poor hygiene or the expectations and entitlement of men in sexual relationships. But when they touched on issues that were even more profound, that's where they found gold. And I think think because the bulk of its writing staff were made up of women and they were drawing from stories from their own personal experiences, they had this great grain of authenticity and intimacy to the characters. Mm. That's why people hooked onto the show. And I think when people disparage Sex and the City, they're failing to acknowledge the episodes that changed the way that women were seen on TV forever. And I think there is a lot of them in Sex and the City. I mean, there's Coulda, Woulda, Shoulda, that was written by Jenny Bix, and it was a whole conversation around abortion, about the choices that women make when they're younger, about the stigma surrounding abortion, because Carrie was very worried about telling her boyfriend Aidan about her own abortion previously. And it's about, you know, the life-changing experience of pregnancy and these discussions about what it is to be a modern professional woman and consider having a baby were never seen before. And, you know, there's this whole idea around how women are always running out of time when it comes to having babies, and that's a really unfair situation. And pregnancy wasn't shown through this joyous lens like it normally is, and abortion wasn't something to be denigrated. I mean, the answers weren't binary. It's a very complicated episode, but it's really free from judgment. And I think people miss that sometimes.
Yeah, and that those very serious debates were there, and discussions were there in some of the episodes for sure. But for the most part, I think what people will remember is, you know, the witty, these wisecracking four characters who seem to be able to bounce off each other with their various problematic areas, whether that was that they were too uptight or not uptight enough, whatever it was. But one of the big searches throughout the series was this idea: was, is there a soulmate? Is there just one person out there for you? And let's listen to a clip featuring all four: Carrie, Sarah Jessica Parker, Charlotte Kristen Davis, Miranda Cynthia Nixon, Samantha Kim Cattrall, discussing this idea of the soulmate.
Dear single. Single? You don't even have a name?
Well, I'm single. I don't deserve one.
Oh. That's the postal equivalent of a drive-by shooting.
Yeah, and I thought those 57 menus I get every day from Hunan Munan were annoying.
Mm. Look at this. Don't let your soulmate slip away.
Oh, I know. It's almost a threat. It's like, we have him. He's just waiting for you, but hurry, because he's slipping away. Oops, there he goes.
Soulmates only exist in the Hallmark aisle in Duane Reade Drugs.
I disagree. I believe that there's that one perfect person out there to complete you.
And if you don't find him, what? You're incomplete? It's so dangerous.
All right, first of all, the idea that there's only one out there, I mean, why don't I just shoot myself right now? I'd like to think that people have more than one soulmate.
I agree. I've had hundreds.
Yeah, and you know what? If you miss one, along comes another, like cats.
No, that is not how it works.
Oh, okay.
But you're still looking outside yourself. It's saying that you're not enough.
Are you enough?
Actually, today she's too much.
Look, the bad thing about the one perfect soulmate is that it's so unattainable. You're being set up to fail.
Exactly, and you feel bad about yourself.
Yeah, and it makes the gap between the Holy Grail and the assholes even bigger.
Well, I don't care. I believe in soulmates.
There you go. A clip from Sex and the City, and we're speaking about it this evening as this promised reboot is on the way. Jen Gannon speaking to me about that. Jen, interesting there. There is one line that jumps out at me from that particular section. It's Kim Cattrall as Samantha Jones when they chat about how many soulmates can you have. And she said, oh, no, yeah, of course, I've had hundreds of soulmates. She always had the funny line. She always had the sparky retort. She was very important to the series, arguably as important as the Sarah Jessica, as the Carrie character who was narrating it and bringing us through the whole story. She's not here in this new reboot.
Yeah, I mean, she was hugely important. I think Samantha Jones is so iconic, not only to a whole female audience, but to a gay audience as well. And I think she was the funniest character of the four. And, you know, she had that dominating presence and those ridiculous one-liners. But she was this unapologetic hedonist. She was very forthright and such a sexual woman, the likes of which we'd never seen on TV before. And I think, you know, she was resolutely single and childless and made that seem like something that was, you know, it is a choice and it's not something that we'd seen before. We'd seen it as being shameful or something that you could be ashamed, should be ashamed of. And I think, you know, people may think that Sex and the City was a show about desperate single women trying to find a man, but a lot of it was taken up with the idea of the rubrics of a relationship and how the fantasies of a conventional life that women adhere to a lot may not be exactly what they need or what they should aspire to. And Samantha Jones was a very much a character that said, you know, you can have another way of life if you want to.
Yeah, but at the end of the final episode of it all, of that set of seasons, wasn't this sense that all four of them were kind of set up in situations and you thought, nah,
why could they not just be left in whatever state they wanted to be in? There was a sense, from my memory, of them being kind of nicely paired off, and there you are, that's your little Hallmark ending.
It did. It very much adhered to some kind of heteronormative sense of situation where it came to romantic love, which is sad. But I think, you know, all shows at the end have to, you know, focus on what it is, the climactic. It's not Breaking Bad. They're not going to get found out or die or go to prison. So the end of the story has to be something to do with romance and love. And I think it is annoying and frustrating if you're a fan that someone like Carrie couldn't have ended up on her own. But I do think, even given that I like the fact that the show did still deal with themes within that, where you had loneliness and the fact that Carrie felt that she was aging out of being deemed attractive and being single over the age of, you know, coming up to 40, which is a really interesting theme that you just don't get on TV at all, because women of a certain age are still not explored in that way as being viable and interesting.
And then there were the films.
Yes. Now, I like to think of the films as completely separate, that they don't actually exist in the same universe at all.
Oh, they do, Jen, unfortunately. It's the same four characters. Although, was Kim Cattrall in the second one?
She is, unfortunately, she is there's just I think a lot of people have become quite snobbish about the TV show because of the tone deaf film iterations, and they were made after the TV series ended, and I think they just reduced the women of the show to these vacuous caricatures and were completely idiotic in terms of race and class. You had in the second one especially women removing their burkas and Samantha throwing condoms around the place, and it was just horrific, and I think it just lost every bit of reality that it had, and it just took these women as being empty, essentially, the caricatures that critics actually accused them of being.
Now, this new season this new 10-part series, isn't it, is called And Just Like That. I presume it's And Just Like That. You're no longer in your 30s stroke heading to your 40s. You're in your 50s stroke heading to your 60s. Is that, or do we know much about what we're going to get there, and who's going to fill the Kim Cattrall shoes?
Well, there's a lot of rumours, but at this stage they're keeping mum about what they're going to do and if they're going to even have a character to replace her. But I do hope, because as the women got older in the series, the sexist jokes from the critics were, you know, they were still referring to them as the new golden girls, and that really highlights how little stories there actually are on TV about women of a certain age. And I hope this is something that the new show will address. Like, they're in their 50s, and I want to see how they deal with that in terms of their relationship, their friendships, their health, their ideas around beauty and sexuality. And women between 40 and 60 are crying out for a show that actually centres them and makes them, you know, as viable and interesting as any man. And I just like that has the potential to do that. Yeah. So with or without Kim Cattrall.
And diversity, can they really get into a new season without addressing diversity in some way, shape or form?
They're going to have to, because, you know, the worst episode of Sex and the City that we all remember is when Samantha dates a black music executive, Siobhan, and the show really descended into horrific racial stereotyping, which Siobhan's sister was portrayed as this angry black woman, and several cliches were being thrown around. And it's very embarrassing, and it proves that writers' rooms need to be diverse in race and sexuality to ensure that this never happens again. And it's recent history, so it's recent pop culture history. Wasn't that long ago, you know?
Yeah. And isn't there another scene that you mentioned, or another episode rather, that you mentioned to us, where one of the characters dates a bisexual man?
Yeah, there's a very narrow view of sexuality on the show, which is hilarious because it's supposed to be about these liberated women living in New York and a sex columnist, you know, it's centred around it. And you could put that down to attitudes at the time, but considering Queer as Folk and This Life were existing in the same time frame, it's a flimsy excuse. And there is this terrible episode where Carrie dates a bisexual man and she's uncomfortable about it, but rather than investigating her own reasoning, the episode is just peppered with these really reductive opinions and cheap jokes, and it just really fails to recognise bisexuality as a legitimate identity. And I think we've come leaps and bounds in the intervening years with regards to sexuality and gender and those kind of issues, and I think they really need to embrace that and get on board with that to have an audience now.
Well, let me go back to some of the great moments then of the original series as well, and I'll get you to come back off the back of this as well, Jen. This is about, because the show really did look at, you know, if you're not married and you don't have children, then you're nobody in the world. It kind of addressed that for many people. And here's a classic example of that. Sarah Jessica Parker as Carrie and Kristen Davis as Charlotte.
You know what? I
am Santa. I did a little mental addition. And over the years, I have bought Kira an engagement gift, a wedding gift. Then there was the trip to Maine for the wedding. 3 baby gifts. In total, I have spent over $2,300 celebrating her choices. And she is shaming me for spending a lousy $485 on myself. Yes, I did the math. But those were gifts. I mean, if you got married or had a child, she would spend the same on you. And if I don't ever get married or have a baby, what? I get bupkis? Think about it. If you are single after graduation, there isn't one occasion where people celebrate you.
We have birthdays.
Oh, no. We all have birthdays. That's a wash. I am talking about the single gal. Hallmark doesn't make a congratulations, you didn't marry the wrong guy card. And where's the flatware for going on vacation alone? You're right.
Uh-huh. Why should I get wedding gifts? Finding Harry was gift enough.
No. I'm thrilled to give you gifts to celebrate your life. I just think it stinks that single people are left out of it. So the moral of the story appears to be, until I get married, I won't be seeing nothing from Kira.
Oh.
Sarah Jessica Parker and Kristen Davis there in a scene from Sex and the City. Jen Gannon with us this evening talking about the hoped for and planned HBO Max and Just Like That, which is a kind of a sequel. We're presuming, do we even know, Jen, that it is going to be the women in their 40s, 50s, 60s? Because if the treatment of the way that the idea of the single person is treated in that clip, if you got something that would treat the lives of women in their 40s, 50s and 60s in the same way, it'd be well worth seeing.
I think so. And I think the atmosphere of the trailer itself, it looks a bit grittier. They just have screens of the cityscapes, New York, and a lot of shots of the subway. And the girls never use the subway in the entire season, so I wonder what that's about. So I'm hoping it will be a more deep delve into the complicated nature of life as you do get older. And I know they did touch on that in relation to Samantha's breast cancer and dealing with elderly parents and, you know, that misogynistic ideal of aging out, of being attractive. They did deal with that previously. So I'm
hoping there was a lovely episode, wasn't there? What was it? Back to My Motherboard.
My Motherboard Myself.
Just explain. There was a beautiful scene in that episode.
There is. And it explores the notion of grief. Miranda's mother dies, and it's about really the strength of friendship and how it really can sustain you. And there's this great moment where Miranda realises she's the only single woman in her family and will have no one with her when she walks down the aisle after her mother's funeral service, and Carrie ends up jumping from her seat and embracing her as she passes by. And I think it hammers home how much society is still built on being in a relationship and has this stigma surrounding women of a certain age being single. And I think, you know, that's something that the show really brought to light.
So you sound as if you're kind of confident that, and just like that, the sequel, or the whatever we call it, the reboot of Sex and the City, that it might have something to offer.
Well, they're going to have to navigate tricky terrain and learn from the mistakes of the films. It's going to be a harder sell to engage an audience in this changed cultural landscape that we have to take an interest in the lives of wealthy white women. But I just think if they concentrate on the authenticity and the emotion that made the initial show so successful and engaging, and it can be truly powerful. I just think they need a writer's room full, a diverse writer's room with regards to race, sexuality, a lot of women, and to possibly remove the influence of Michael Patrick King. He was responsible for the two disastrous films that almost killed the legacy and the franchise in itself. So
would diversity include putting a man into that writer's room?
Maybe so. Just the one now, mind you.
Okay, fair enough. Now, just before, thanks for that. So Just Like That, going into production this year. But before you head off anywhere, we're talking about potentially that new series celebrating women in their 40s, 50s and 60s. Let's celebrate a woman who is celebrating her 75th birthday today. You're a big Dolly Parton fan, Jen.
I do love Dolly Parton. And Dolly Parton, let's say, is she saving the world? Like, I mean, with the vaccine, her involvement in the vaccine, her involvement in literacy programs in, you know, throughout America and in Ireland, there's nothing that she can't do. Like, I mean, as for a woman that is just dismissed, as she herself calls herself, a backwards Barbie, she has done so much. Like, apart from being an absolutely essential songwriter, she's a great force in the world. And I can't wait for 75 more years of Dolly.
Absolutely. At least, please. My Tennessee Mountain Home is the track that we're going to play, of course, referring to her home place of Tennessee. And this is from her 1973 album of the same name. Happy birthday, Dolly.
Sitting on the front porch on a summer afternoon, in a straight back chair on two legs, leaned against the wall. Watched the kids playing with June bugs on a string, and chased the glowing fireflies when evening shadows fall.
And off she goes. Born in the town of Pittman Center in Tennessee, in a small cabin on the banks of Lake Little Pigeon River. That is Dolly Parton celebrating her 75th birthday today. Just coming up to 28 minutes past 7 on Tuesday night, Serena. Brian Bilson is a poet and author based in Oxford, and in his new collection, Alexa, What Is There to Know About Love?, he explores affairs of the heart in all kinds of scenarios, from the internet era all the way back to the ancient Greeks and indeed to cavemen. Known as the Banksy of poetry, humour is the hallmark of his work, full of wordplay and visual gags. Safe to say that if you're reading a Bilson poem, you want to be on your toes while doing so. Brian Bilson joins me now. Let's start with the title poem, Alexa, What Is There to Know About Love? Maybe you'd introduce it for us, Brian, and read it.
Yes, of course. Yes, as you say, this is a book of quite a few poems about love, of which this is the central one, and it's based on a conversation with an Amazon Alexa. Alexa, what is there to know about love? What is there to know about love? A glove is a garment that covers the hand for protection from the cold or dirt, and Alexa, how does a human heart work? How does a human heart work? Blood is first received in the right atrium via two veins, the vena cava superior and inferior. Alexa, where do we go to when we die? Where do we go to when we die? Activating Google Maps. Completed activation. Would you like to start from your current location? Alexa, what does it mean to be alone? What does it mean to be alone? It is the silence left by words unsaid, the cold expanse of half a bed. It is the endless stretching of the hours, the needless tending of plastic flowers. It is an echo unanswered in a cave, the fateful ping of a microwave. It is the fraying of a worn shirt cuff and the howl, Alexa, stop! That's enough.
Brian Bilson with his poem, Alexa, What Is There to Know About Love? That the title poem in his new and second collection. I'm just wondering how many computers around the country are now going mad, or little speakers in the side of people's rooms trying to answer the questions that you have been asking in that poem, Brian. Did you ask Alexa that question as part of your research, or how did you go about writing the poem in that respect?
Oh, I didn't actually. I don't actually own an Alexa myself. In fact, I don't think I could think of much worse than having somebody in my house listening in to me and trying to answer all the questions that I don't really want answering.
Yeah, now that's interesting. The questions that you don't want answering, because it really did strike that poem. Perhaps, and even though I did get you to read it first, it touches on some of the humour that's in the collection. But there's quite a serious side to it as well. So were you addressing questions that you found difficult to address?
Well, I think in a lot of my poems, although on the surface, they do attempt at some form of humour. I do try to write about things that might resonate more deeply, and as I kind of hope that all kind of poetry does, really. And I think just because something is deemed as being comic, it doesn't doesn't preclude it from being from kind of being more profound as well.
Yeah, because it is, I suppose, it's not often that we put comedy and poetry in the same sentence or in the same place as each other. Is that an annoyance to you? Is it a barrier that you'd like to break down?
Well, I mean, I think there's a grand tradition of humour in poetry, but it often gets a bad rap, and it's often sort of just dismissed as being light verse, and that does annoy me. And I think like all areas of poetry. You know, some poems are good, some are bad, and people's views of what constitutes good poetry or bad poetry kind of depends on the individual and how that is received. Because actually, even doggerel sometimes can catch somebody's attention and resonate with them in some kind of way. So I think the whole concept of light verse is an irritant.
And it's patronizing and dismissive.
That's exactly right. It kind of suggests that there's that it concerns itself with the trivial, and what isn't light verse is kind of serious and important and profound in a way that other things can't be.
Your first collection, Brian, was called You Took the Last Bus Home, and that was published in 2016. Now, you've said that you accidentally became a poet via Twitter. Tell us a little bit about how that happened.
Well, it does seem rather accidental, because I joined Twitter not to share poems. In fact, I wasn't really sharing any of my poems with anyone at that stage. And I really joined it to find out what people at work were kind of talking about when they'd say things like, we must really, streamline our social media strategy. And I had no idea really what they were banging on about. So I thought I'd join. I joined under a pseudonym. And it was only probably after a year or so of being on Twitter that I decided to start, tweeting a few poems out there. And so this wasn't any kind of deliberate strategy. I've never, I've not entered poetry competitions or, been to poetry festivals, etc. So it all seems rather bizarre sometimes.
Yeah, and now you say you entered Twitter under a pseudonym. Was Brian Bilson the pseudonym that you entered under? Because it, like Banksy, and it's often that comparison is made between you and Banksy, that Brian Bilson is the pseudonym and you've remained pretty anonymous, apart from radio interviews where you're not seen and things like that.
the name Brian itself was a name that I'd used previously when I've been doing a bit of other writing. I used to kind of write spoof football match reports, and Brian Bilson struck me as the perfect kind of name for a local football correspondent. And so that was the name I kind of picked when I joined it. So partly so that people didn't really know that I was on Twitter, so I could be at work and spending my day tweeting, and all of my colleagues were none the wiser.
But presumably some of your colleagues, at least at this stage, have copped on that, he was absent. Oh, that's when Brian Bilson's book of poems appeared. I know that voice from somewhere. That's the guy three desks down from me, or wherever it may be in your particular workplace.
Well, yes, over time, but it was probably 3 or 4 years before anyone really knew that. Even sort of, friends and family, I wouldn't really tell them about this secret life of mine.
Secret poetry life. First date. Will you read that for me? Just as in terms of what I suppose there have been some people known to do what your narrator does in this poem. Let's have a listen.
Okay. First date. With so much in common, that was clear from the start. A marriage of souls like de Beauvoir and Sartre. The connection was instant, almost irrational, simply simpatico, fully compatible. You confessed you love winter, North Yorkshire and cats. Me too, I responded. How amazing is that? You were wild about Wharton. You loved Ethan Frome. His best, I said, thinking I'd read him when home. You praised the revival of Pinter's Dumb Waiter. I nodded along. I should Google that later. The discussion then turned to things that you hated. Tarantino, you thought, was quite overrated. You make some good points, I eventually said. I could always hide that box set under my bed. You spoke of a loathing of poetry that rhymed, and I said, yes, that stuff's awful.
And you have another poem, Brian Bilson, that's First Date from the new collection, Alexa, What Is There to Know About Love? But you have another poem where you give some guidelines to young poets, in fact, and you show them how to not rhyme if they so decide to go about doing that. But there's a lot of heartbreak in this book, Brian, a lot of missed opportunities and relationships that seem to go wrong, including between Plato and Mrs. Plato, it has to be said, as far back as that. How much of it is pure imagination? How much of it is based on personal experience in the office that people don't know who you are?
Well, there's a bit of both. I mean, I wasn't knocking around when Mrs. Plato was around. however, I, you know, there's, it, you know, it started off purely as a book of love poems. And, you know, the thing is about when you're trying to write about love, you know, you can kind of do that for a certain amount of time. There's certain, there are many angles you can go at. You've got obviously romantic love or platonic love. And, you know, there's the happiness that it can bring, but also there is the heartbreak too. And I wanted to kind of show it from lots of different angles, some of which were more personal to me. The only thing is the problem about sort of waking up every day trying to write a love poem is that it gets rather nauseous after a while. and so I kind of slightly abandoned the project of this being a purely book of love poetry. Because I simply got sick of writing them.
Yeah, and you get very political, particularly in is it section three? There are four sections in the book. In this third section of the book, you get quite political with a poem called 57 Varieties, where you give us 57 varieties of Brexit, and the poem immediately afterwards, Hold My Hand and Let's Jump Off This Cliff, which is, again, a direct reference to Brexit and the fact that your doctor has said in the poem, at any rate, the doctor has said, if you jump off this cliff, you could probably die. Have you landed? Do you think you've landed from the jump off the cliff yet in terms of your own country and in terms of Brexit?
Oh, no, I feel like we're still plummeting, which is a slightly kind of scary thought. And I'm not quite sure when it is we're going to hit the ground. But I suspect given the height we're falling from, it won't be a very comfortable landing.
And if it's a height you're falling from, it may take a while before the ground is met.
Yes, exactly.
Maybe you'd read, as we finish up, you'd read a poem called The White House. I think it needs no introduction, but it's interesting given the day that is in it today in Washington, that what you have to say in this poem.
Of course, The White House. He's repainting the White House in washed out tones of white, pale shimmer and frosted death, sour milk and clouded light, bleached lichen in the kitchen, in the bedroom's faded tan, pure white in the Oval Office, the new range from the Dulux clan.
And that's The White House from Brian Bilson and his new collection, Alexa, What Is There to Know About Love? Again, Brian, yeah, it's very funny, but it's very serious within all of that. I presume this was written shortly after the inauguration of the current president or during his term of office.
Well, how could you possibly guess that?
How astute of me to notice. So today we're in the final 24 hours or whatever state Washington is in, time zone wise, we're in certainly the closing moments of the current presidency. Are you more optimistic about the new presidency? Will there be a poem that's a little less scathing than that one coming from your pen?
Well, I hope so. I'm not even sure I'll be writing many poems about Joe Biden. I think I only wrote so many poems about Trump because the kind of felt like there was so much to say. Both, I think both out of anger, but just out of kind of fascination at the same time. You know, and so obviously Biden's a very different character, and I'm hoping that he doesn't. In some ways, I'm hoping he doesn't move me to poetry because it's probably I quite often use poetry almost as in a sort of passive-aggressive way to get certain things out of my system. And it would be quite nice just actually not to think about the president of the United States for a while. And unfortunately, I suspect Trump's not going to go away in a hurry, or certainly his legacy won't. So there'll probably be more poems coming to social media on the state of American politics, unfortunately.
Yeah, a bit like the fall from the Brexit cliff. Maybe we haven't reached the ground quite yet. Brian, lovely to speak with you this evening. Thanks for being with us. That's Brian Bilston speaking to us about his current poetry collection, Alexa, What Is There to Know About Love? Sorry if your machine has gone off again. And that book is published by Picador. Elmer Bernstein, one of the true greats of cinematic composition, over 150 original movie scores and 4 Oscar nominations to his name, and his music remains as fresh and vibrant today as when it was first experienced on the big screen by movie audiences from the 1950s onward. The Magnificent Seven, Ghostbusters and Cape Fear, amongst many others. And in a moment, I'll be joined by Joe Chibby, General Manager of the RTE Concert Orchestra, to answer our regular Tuesday question, where do I begin with? And he'll be talking about where to begin with in terms of Elmer Bernstein. Well, I'm going to start, for the moment anyway, here. You know, isn't it impossible to hear that without seeing Steve McQueen walking back over to solitary confinement and bouncing his baseball off the ground and the wall while doing so? That is Elmer Bernstein's music for The Great Escape. And Joe Chibby, General Manager of the RTE Concert Orchestra, is with me now to look back at an extraordinary career and recommend some of the highlights for you to listen to in your olden time. But The Great Escape is as good a place as any to start, I would have thought, Joe. But you worked with Elmer Bernstein. Before we get into his music, tell us about him, the man.
Well, he was an incredible character. He floated into the room. He was always welcoming, warm, upbeat and charismatic. It seemed that, you know, his pace in life was the pace that he did his recording sessions as well. You know, nothing was ever rushed. It was always polite and well-behaved, very fluid, keeping things moving. His writing ability and orchestration skills were, you know, that of a genius. I first worked with him actually on a film called The Grifters, which was a Martin Scorsese film, which starred John Cusack and Annette Bening. And it was a brass-heavy, street jazz, quirky rhythm section-driven soundtrack with the orchestra on top. And Elmer had the ability to write while standing on the podium. And this was the first time I'd actually ever witnessed this in anybody. It was quite startling, you know. He didn't have to sit at a piano. He could hear it in his head and he could adapt it to the score straight away. And he really included you in what he was doing. You know, if he wanted a change in the part, he'd come down and he'd stand beside you and he wouldn't bring the score. He'd come down with his pencil and he'd change the part.
Wow.
That you were reading from, you know. So he was quite you were part of it, you know, you were in his party. You know, you were committed to his score. Because of that, he was a very personable person, you know.
But you mentioned there the brass heavy aspect of The Grifters, and certainly not always, but to a large extent, I would have thought Elmer Bernstein, if you know, we will be playing The Magnificent Seven at some point along the way. You know, when you think of Western music and Ennio Morricone, you're thinking of a much sparser type of music. Elmer Bernstein loved the big sound. He loved the big orchestration, didn't he?
He did, yeah. I think that's, you know, he came from his background. Well, his background was he was training as a concert pianist, and he was more an improviser than a reader. So he loved improvising. I think he loved jazz, and then he got obviously. He had to go to war in World War II as part of the army, but he was a score writer and he entertained the troops. So he would have been used to that sort of the marching band scenario, the jazz style, brass lit rhythm section sort of environment. So I think because of that, he just loved the energy of brass instruments and woodwind instruments. So he kind of wrote in that style. And The Great Escape is a good example of that. And The Man with the Golden Arm, which is in a jazzy style, but it's still brass instruments, you know, still woodwind. And then there's an orchestra on top, you know, but it's very much he loved to keep it lit. That's for sure.
And he was part of that New York, the Jewish immigrant family that he came from, you know, not dissimilar in lots of ways to George Gershwin, Leonard Bernstein, Andre Previn, Irving Berlin. Is there something in that tradition that feeds into the way he orchestrates, feeds into his music?
Well, I think if you look from before that time, lots of people were getting out of Europe, you know, so Central, Eastern Europe, you know, and they came with a bag of goods, which were they had amazing instruments, you know, these are musician types, I suppose, had amazing instruments. They had amazing education in academic music through the teaching of their colleges, etc. And they were bringing that to America. And all of these guys, you know, they had that skill set and they entered into the golden age of Hollywood. They had departments of composers and orchestrators and copyists and heads of music, and they all existed, which, you know, that doesn't exist unless you're on a big film today. It's usually one, three people, because technology exists, it's narrowed right down. So the director goes right to the composer, he writes, and it's delivered, you know. So it's probably a copyist or whatever involved. But they were there at the right time, they had the right knowledge, they were multi-genre musicians and composers. They loved, you know, I think they loved the environment of writing as well. Everything, you know, melodic themes and motifs were being mixed up with different styles of harmony, be it jazz or more contemporary music. They used operatic choices to tie into characters. So it was an amazing time, you know, the great, great knowledge and understanding of innovation of music as well, you know, be it tradition, jazz, classical, world music. They just got involved. They were rich in creativity, yeah. You know.
I'll come back to what happened to him around the McCarthy era and the House on American Activities, all of that. But I just want to get another bit of music in, and this is from a little bit later on. His score for Cape Fear, not quite as bright and breezy as The Great Escape, it has to be said, but just as big. The darkness of Cape Fear, caught perfectly there by Elmer Bernstein in his score for the film. Joe Chibby with me this evening is talking about where to start with Elmer Bernstein. And that's a nod, actually. We were all saying it here as we were listening. You can hear Bernard Herrmann in there for sure, can't you?
Big time, yeah, absolutely. So I think that was he maybe did a rework and a tip of the hat to Bernard Herrmann's original score, which is amazing, you know. And when you think of, I remember watching that when I was younger, and Robert De Niro at his craziest.
Yeah.
My God,
yeah,
it was really, really, really very scary film.
Yeah, and I'll come back now to that whole idea of, because that was his career had to be revived effectively after the McCarthy era. He didn't name names. He refused to get involved in that whole side of things. What happened to him because of that?
Well, he did work as a pianist and a composer for a small communist party, which were Friends of America. But just because of that, you know, the witch hunt, I suppose, was on, and you could get blacklisted for any sort of left to centre ideas about politics in that time. And he wasn't a member of a communist party, but he was grey listed, which meant they only half went after him. But the contracts for the big films went south, you know, and he ended up doing B movies like Robot Monster and Catwoman of the Moon, so not ideal for somewhere like Elmer Bernstein. But he was caught up in that. But at the same time, when he was caught up in it, McCarthy was already being censored by the Senate. So he was kind of, you know, he was. It seems like he was going to be okay. So he was actually working for Cecil B. DeMille at the time, and he was famously anti-communist, and he was the president of the organization called the Motion Pictures Alliance, which was devoted to keeping communist propaganda out of movies. But DeMille liked Elmer, it seems, so he called him to his office and he asked him straight out. He said, "Are you a member of a communist party?" And Elmer just said, "Not a chance. No, I'm not." You know, so apparently he stared at him. He stared him down for about 10-20 seconds, and he believed his story. But I mean, that saved his career, because Cecil B. DeMille was such a heavyweight in the music industry, and it got him onto. It was at the, I suppose, the misfortune of another composer who was very ill at the time. But it got him onto the Ten Commandments, which was basically, you know, Wagner in Egypt, with Charlton Heston and Yul Brynner. And the I was looking at the figures for that movie, and actually it only cost 10-12 million to make, but it made 115 million at box office, so it was a massive hit, you know. And it took care of his It took care of his career in a way. He was so big then, you know.
Yeah, and again, Cecil B. DeMille, Charlton Heston, The Ten Commandments. Yeah. We're talking big score. We're talking big everything, as you say, Wagner on the screen.
Big time.
He was capable of writing in a much more, I suppose, reflective and smaller style as well. And this one will bring us a little bit closer to home. My Left Foot. Let's have a listen. Some of Emil Bernstein's music for My Left Foot. Joe Chibby speaking to us about the great American film composer this evening. And really, there obviously the brass were blown out at that point. Their lips were done. And he said, take a bit of time off. It is much thinner type of texture. And thinner isn't the right word. It's just not as heavy as the brass-based stuff that we've been listening to up to this.
No, and it's actually very light. So, I mean, I suppose when you look at My Left Foot, it was a very heavy narrative. But, he made it quite childlike as well, you know. So, I mean, you hear an instrument in there called the Owens Martineau. And if you were a fan of Star Trek back in the day, that was the instrument that you heard. And it was a keyboard instrument and also like an electronic sort of wire that was followed with a little ring around a stick, you know. And that created this wavering sort of flute-like sound, you know. But it was the first time we had seen it in Ireland. So he certainly was a trendsetter in terms of creating new sonic sort of soundscapes, you know.
And how did they get Bernstein on board for My Left Foot, do you know?
Well, he was a friend of Noel Pearson's. So Noel Pearson, obviously the great theatre producer, obviously, and he went into films then, and he won an Oscar with My Left Foot. Mm. But they were just friends. When Noel Pearson got married, apparently he went to Elmer's house in California, and he stayed with him for a while with his new wife and whatever. So they just, I don't know, they were just friends. They became friends through other friends, I suppose, you know.
Yeah. And did he do the music for the wedding? Do you know?
Probably did.
Wouldn't be bad. Wouldn't be bad to have Elmer Bernstein as your music composer for your wedding, would it?
No.
And in terms then of the type of legacy that he has, that Bernstein has across film music, how would you describe that, Joe?
Well, I think he was definitely a trendsetter. He came from a good time in music in Hollywood. He was able to cross so many different genres, you know. So he was a guy who started as a classical piano player, and then he was obviously schooled by Aaron Copland, who was a big American composer, and then he went into the army band scenario. So he had all these great skill sets. He knew a lot of languages and music, and he had this great ability to write for scenes. So he sort of wrote them like they were an opera in a way, you know. So, and one very interesting thing was I was speaking to Brian Masterson, who was a co-owner in Windmill Lane, Rings End Road Studios. I was talking to him last night, and he engineered and mixed Elmer's sessions when he was in Ireland. And Elmer spoke to him about the first emotion, and the first emotion he referred to was what we see on the screen, and the emotion after that is what is created by the music. And I thought this was really interesting. So he wrote for the second emotion. So he looked for something else to add on to it and underpin the first emotion. So that was quite interesting. And he said to Brian, he said, I've never told anybody that. So Brian had a private secret he was carrying for the last 30 years.
And now we all know.
We all know, yeah. So it was quite amazing. He had this, you know, he looked at everything. He was very, very clever.
Interesting way of thinking of it, though. The visuals are the first emotion. The music is the second emotion. Some might argue with that, but it's a very interesting point. We'll finish with The Magnificent Seven. This is him at his best, Joe.
Brilliant, absolutely, yeah. Western score, you know, I mean, when you think of everything that he's done and he's doing a score for a Western, it's just brilliant.
Ah,
You see, we don't get much chance to get out into the big wide open world at the moment, do we? But the music of Elmer Bernstein can certainly make you feel as if you're on the open plains of the western states of America. That is his music from The Magnificent Seven, and it was Joe Chibby who was speaking to us tonight about where we might begin with the music of Elmer Bernstein and bringing tonight's programme to a finish. Leah Murphy, Paula Shields researched, Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator, Kieran Dunn was on sound this evening, and tonight's programme was produced by Olam McGowan. Talk to you tomorrow night at 7.